This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Your co-workers sue calling plants a cesspool of racial discrimination.
16 African-American and Latino production workers are suing Coca-Cola, accusing the company of relegating them to less favorable assignments, unfair disciplinary action, and retaliation for complaining. The workers say they were subject to racial epithets, and the people who used them went unpunished, according to the legal complaint that's been filed. The suits are centered on two production plants, one in Maspeth, Queens, and the other in Elmsford in Westchester.
In studio is Ramon Hernandez, a haulage driver fired from the Elmsford Westchester plant, and Ray Rogers with the campaign to stop Killer Coke. And we're also joined by Yvette Butler, a mechanic fired from the Maspeth Queens plant.
And I want to start with Ramon. Ramon, your experience that led you to file a complaint for discrimination against Coca-Cola. What? Coca-Cola? As American as apple pie? Not as wholesome, that's for sure, but tell us about your experience.
Thanks for having me. I started working at Coca-Cola back in around the beginning of 1995. I worked at the Smithtown branch on Long Island, and from there I transferred to Elmsford, New York, approximately around 1999, until I was fired in 2009. During that time, the events that led to my dismissal from Coca-Cola was that one of the clerks addressed me by the N-word, and I went to the supervisor, my transportation manager, actually, and I complained to him. Now, Coca-Cola is supposed to have a zero tolerance for that kind of behavior, and when I went and complained to him, he suggested that I demand an apology from this man, and if he did not comply with my request, then I would have to go back to the manager, tell him, and then he would address that issue. But the plant manager happened to overhear the conversation, and then he stopped the whole thing, and he was dealt with. Now, even after this man was suspended, the same manager twice tried to coach me on what to say and go to human resources and tell him the guy didn't mean it, or try to keep the guy from getting fired. Even though the guy admitted to addressing me by the N-word, this guy still tried to get me to go and bear false witness, which I did not, because I'm not into bearing false witness, and I gave him my reasons why I wouldn't do that. Everything started going downhill after that. I was put in a position as a dispatcher. From there, I was able to see how the work was being distributed and the unfairness of the whole system that they had implemented, where most of the work was being taken from the minority driver, which most of the junior guys, it's a union shop. Most of the union guys that are junior are minorities. So I raised a concern about that because I noticed how all the workers were being allowed to work, 10, 11 hours, while some of the best workers that we had, like one of the brothers that is in the lawsuit, his name is John Tindall, this guy will give you all the work that you requested from him. He'll work, his 10 hours, give you 3, 4, 5 loads if you let him run. But instead, this is one of the best drivers that we have in there is held back, even though he's back then he was, I think, number 17 on the seniority list out of about 100 drivers. He was still being held back while people that had less seniority than him were being allowed to work all kinds of different hours. And as far as the overtime goes, and it didn't matter how many loads they did, but this is a guy that will produce for you if you let him work. So I complained about that, we also noticed that we didn't have a shop steward election in about 35 years at Coca-Cola. Everybody that was a shop steward, somebody that was actually put as a shop steward. So that's another issue that I had. So I gathered enough signatures to actually have an election. I got my election. The guy that ran actually won, and I was designated as the alternate shop steward, where I only lasted one day, needless to say, on the job.
One day.
And yes. And
you're my kind of shop steward.
Yes, I was gone. I guess the power went to my head, and I went crazy.
Yes.
So that was the last day that I worked at Coca-Cola, the day after the election, the shop steward election that I worked so hard to get.
Well, we're going to follow through on that later on, but I also wanted to bring Yvette into the conversation. And Yvette, why don't you tell us your experience with Coca-Cola in Maspeth, Queens?
My experience there was very, very, very trying. I mean, it was very harsh. I came to them in 2003. I applied for the mechanics position. Due to my background, I was called in for my interview, I got the job, but once I got there, I was not allowed to go directly into my department and work with my male counterparts due to the fact that I was told that they wouldn't be comfortable having a female come up in there. And from then on, coworkers, supervisors, managers, they made it very clear that I didn't belong. You know, they didn't feel comfortable with having me there working in that company, especially in that department.
Yvette, let me just ask you, referencing your skill as a mechanic, and you are a woman, still, unfortunately, there are not enough women trained in those kind of capacities. Was there also an element based on racial discrimination that impacted? Could you tell us more about that as well?
Well, there was always comments made, you know, black this, black that. It wasn't just directly directed towards me. It was also directed to my other coworkers who was black, African descent, too.
Yvette, also, in your complaint also, in the lawsuit, you mentioned questions of training that you were not given where white workers were given that training.
Oh, yeah. Plenty of times, I asked to cross-train in certain areas, and they just felt that I was told from one supervisor who then became my manager, well, if you know that you got the job as a mechanic, why do you need to be cross-trained? But in fact, the other mechanics that was of a different race, they got all the training they wanted. You know, all they had to do was sign their name, and all of them got the training. You know, if they did give me any training, it was in one area. You know, they kept me locked down in one area to get trained. They wouldn't cross-train me on the different lines. They wouldn't allow me to learn these lines. I used to have to go after I did my job, whatever they assigned me to do. I would go over to the other lines just to familiarize myself with the machines. And if they caught me over there, I would be, like, written up saying that I was being insubordinate. But yet and still, they wouldn't allow me to train on these machines. But when the guys that was accountable to stay on that line and run that whole line, when they was absent or whatever, they would want to just throw me over there and expect me to be able to hold down the line.
Ray Rogers?
Yeah, I'd like to add something about Yvette's situation. She had two strikes against her working in these plants. One, she was a woman, but she was also a black woman. She was also put on a very dangerous job where she was supposed to have a number of other coworkers working and helping her. They left her alone in a very dangerous situation.
Line four filler. They assigned me to change over a line four filler completely by myself. First, he put one mechanic with me, but in the middle of the changeover, in the beginning of the changeover, automatically he pulls this guy. He pulls Abdul Salim off, and he tells me I have to do it by myself. This is Ron Sampa again, the same one who tried to get me to use a match in a flammable area and blow myself up or damage equipment in a soap suspension area where they had nothing but flammable materials in there. That's the same person who had me change over line four. And when I went to the shop steward that was on that shift that night, and complained to him, asked him, why is he allowing this to happen? He says to me, well, don't worry. You know how to change it over, right? If it takes you 10 hours, change it over. Just show them that you know how to change over the machine. So I took that into consideration, but it was a very stressful thing to do because I had no one to, like, help me pull the heavy parts of the equipment into the machine. I had no one to watch my back in case, you know, something flipped on or whatever. They left me there to either hurt myself really bad or to do really bad damage on the equipment. That's the risk that they was taking, and that's how bad this person wanted me out of that department.
But Ray, our friend here, Ramona, said that Coke has a zero tolerance policy. So how do these individual instances where people feel that they have been discriminated against, that they have been treated disparately, how does that fit in or jive with the contradiction seemingly of a zero policy? Why don't we give Ray some response?
Coke has a zero policy when anybody challenges what's happening in these plants that are dangerous or discriminatory. And talk a minute about the emotional stress that goes on these workers. What Yvette hasn't told you yet is when they figured a way to fire her, it was based on discrimination, she ended up with three children and herself living in a shelter for 13 months. You can see the stress in this woman's face to this day. When she came into my office, I realized what this woman has gone through, and I read her case. And she's just one of many cases like this. Sandra Walker, another woman, black woman, she kept raising issues, and she finally said to one of the supervisors, "You're a racist." The supervisor goes and claims that she said, "You're a dead man." She was suspended for 5 weeks without pay, only to find out, with many witnesses there, that she never said, "You're a dead man." She said, "You're a racist." She was suspended 5 weeks and never received any compensation for those 5 weeks of work lost. I can tell you a number of workers, including men, including Ramon next here to me, have admitted within a group, "Look, I'm a grown man. I broke down and cried because of the pressure on me." Will Nunez, really strapping, tough-looking guy, okay? He thought he was having a heart attack twice because of the stress put on him for these conditions. He was taken in an ambulance thinking that he was having a heart attack rather than the panic attacks that he was having. So the emotional toll that is taking on many workers, Oral Forbes, who was in my office yesterday, who got fired after 4.5 years to tell his story, and he ends up losing his home, losing his auto, having to move in with his in-laws. He's got a couple of children. I can go on and on and on with these kind of stories.
And these are acts of, they're fired because of resistance against the discrimination that they're facing?
Exactly. It's retaliation for standing up and speaking out. Now, obviously, you could say, and I don't want to get into all the situation, Ramon mentioned the union. These should also be serious union matters. Unfortunately, these are not being addressed. So this is really a battle between these employees and Coca-Cola. They stand up, they're retaliated against, and it's having an incredible impact. Again, what happens when they speak up, they're met with unfair disciplinary practices. They can be suspended. And then many like Ramon or like Yvette, they're outright fired. They lose their job.
And Ray, just very quickly, it's not just the workers that we're talking about here, the one in the complaint for 16 workers and also Yvette's complaint. There are others throughout the country that you've been hearing about.
Yes,
right?
There are. And just in these plants alone, I can tell you right now, there are many dozens that have come forth beyond the 16. Also, we've gotten complaints from New Jersey, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and there's also one person involved in the lawsuits from Smithtown, but there are many others that have made it very clear we have very serious problems here at the Smithtown plant in Long Island.
Do I actually hear, Yvette, are you kind of sobbing?
Yes, I am, because this is very hurtful and it's very stressful. After, it's been 5 years, ma'am, and even though it's been 5 years, this is something that really, truly hurts my core, because it's like nothing has been done to, nothing's been rectified, and on top of that, I'm hearing so many other people complaining and coming out with their stories. So this means that Coca-Cola, CCE, whatever, whoever the owners of this company is, they don't care once they damage a person's life. It's like, okay, we got rid of that problem, and they move on to the next, and they just constantly go through year after year getting away with it. When is it going to stop? When is somebody going to make this company pay for what they're doing to people's lives? They're damaging not only the people who work there. Like Ray said, I have three children. Ramon has children. We are not just people, single people, but even if we were single, it would still do damage to a person's life. You understand? And it's nothing being done, and it's just very draining. It makes me very emotional every time I speak about this,
Of course.
They forced me. I was forced into signing a one chance, last chance agreement. It took them a week to get me to sign this, okay? And they only did it because they knew they couldn't get me on my performance. They couldn't get me on work performance or anything. I was a professional. I came from Columbia Presbyterian. This was not my first job. This was my career. It wasn't a job for me. It was a job that I said I was going to make into a career. But they didn't give me a chance. Mm. None of them in that place gave me a chance. I was a target from the time I walked into that place.
Ramon?
Yeah. Another side of the whole problem with the discrimination of Coca-Cola is after you get fired, a lot of people will say, well, why don't you just move on? But you're not allowed to move on because people like Yvette, people like myself, Oral Forbes, and Luis Morales, the guy from Smithtown, we can't find a job. We're still looking for employment. Like in my case, it took me about 5 months to get a real job, and I figured out why just by coincidence. I went and filled out an application with my current employer, and they called me back, and they asked me, actually, did you ever work for Coca-Cola? Because I have filled out the application, and I put in that I worked for Coke for almost 15 years, so I had to bring proof. And then he told me that when they went to do a background check on me and check on my pre-employment, do the pre-employment check, Coca-Cola denied that I ever worked for them. Now, the funny thing is that when I applied for my unemployment benefits, I received a letter from the Department of Labor, which I still have at home, where they say that Coca-Cola denied that they fired me, that I was just on leave. So it's like I'm on leave to the Department of Labor, but then to my employer, I never worked there. So they do whatever they can to prevent you from being able to get a job. And that's why so many of us lose everything.
Because a lot of those supervisors that led to run that place and be in charge of that place, I was strictly on night duty. I mean, once in a while, they would put me on day shift. Predominantly, my whole career there was during the night. I used to have to leave my children. I used to have to drive from Park Slope all the way to Maspeth, Queens. I was there mostly at night. I became
from Park Slope to my neighborhood. Sorry.
And unfortunately, that's the neighborhood I was forced out of. I lost. I raised my kids there for 16 years, and I was forced into a shelter. I had to stay in a shelter for 13 months. See the damage that was done to me due to this company being able to do what they do. That's why it's so emotional for me when I speak about it.
Well, as our time draws to a close for this segment, and I really, your pain is quite evident, and that's why I want to, Ray, what is to be done? Where are we going with these complaints that certainly these workers claim are systemic within the culture of the Coca-Cola plants?
We're taking these workers and we're making sure that they get out in front of the public. They come on to radio stations like this. They go out and they do demonstrations. We're going to take workers into the annual meeting of one of Coke's largest investors where they can tell their story. And we're going to make people realize that the problem starts at the very top with Coke CEO Muhtar Kent. Muhtar Kent is a liar. He lied at the annual shareholders meeting. He brought people down from these plants in New York to lie. And let me just sum up. One of the people he brought down to put a good face in what's happening at the plants in New York, this same person is involved in an EEOC complaint where he stated, "Black American women are not capable of washing themselves properly. They smell bad and their homes are nasty and filthy." This man also referred to certain kinds of food as slavery food. This is one of the people that Coca-Cola had stand up, one of five people, to tell others that there are no problems at our plants in New York.
What is to be done?
And we need a website for people to find out more information also.
Okay, for all the people that are listening that want to give us their support, please visit thecoke16.com. And from there, you can like us on Facebook. There's a little box on the left-hand side. We need your support. The more people that like us, the more that we can get this message out about what's really going on behind the walls of Coca-Cola.
One more time, Ramon Hernandez, where do we visit?
The Coke 16. 16 is a 1-6. You can also Google us, and it'll show up right away.
Also, go to killercoke.org. Let me repeat, killercoke.org, and we have on our menu racial discrimination in Coke facilities, and you'll find out all the information. A new website, stopcokediscrimination.org.
And you'll learn a lot more about the other things that Coke does in the world community. This is a dastardly company on a local and international level. And Yvette Butler, all we can say is thank you for being on. My sister, do stay strong. You do have supporters out there. I know this litigation is going to be successful. Ramon Hernandez and Ray Rogers for bringing people together, fighting the good fight. And we're going to root out by the roots and the branch the discrimination of what is really now the Killer Coke plants. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And they don't call it Killer Coke for nothing. Go to the website. There's a lot more information.
Absolutely.
Especially what's happening in Colombia, South America.
Which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on? No matter what. Which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on? No matter what.
See, I gotta draw a line, I can't take it no more. If you ain't down with revolution, what you waiting for? Making money for suckers and not communities poor. Ripping flags off of coffers, man, it's ain't our war. Colonized and terrorized by the world's biggest killers. The US government, the biggest weapon and drug dealers. Filling prisons with children, incarcerating the future. MySpace and Facebook got us stuck on computers. Stuck on stupid bumping music that's abusive to the shorties. And the nonsense that you spitting, they just listening, absorbing. I've been dormant, I've been working, I'm a giant, I'm ready. I'm with the Apple and Oaxaca and we hold the machetes. I rock hard like pallets feeding children holding slingshots. I'm with every single kid that's down for hip-hop. For the culture, the life, what it really stands for. This music is resistance, it's the voice of the poor. I'm on the side of the workers, the teachers, the lunch ladies. On the streets with brown mommies, raising our brown babies. I'm with youth organizers, cleaning up the Bronx River. I'm like Jaime Escalante when I stand and deliver. I'm with Evo Morales, man, he running Bolivia. Distribution of the land so we can all live bigger. I'm with Hugo and Fidel, Grandmaster and Melly Mel. I'm with the Panthers up in Queens, justice for Sean Bell. I'm with Camacho Negron, I'm with Ojeda Rios. Freedom for Oscar López, time to get in the field. I'm with a blue Jamal, I'm with a Sada Shakur. I'm with the compas in the mall, got he getting a penny more.
We are going to bring you right now a representative of Local 1-2 of the Utility Workers of America, because we want to know what's happening now with our sisters and brothers who have been on the picket line for 16 days.
Online is John Milia, who is the spokesperson for Local 1-2 of the Utility Workers of America. John, how are the negotiations going?
Well, thanks for having me on. The negotiations are not going well. For the past 16 days since Con Ed threw 8,500 New York families onto the street, they stuck to their guns. They seem as if they want to break the union. And at the same time, they're endangering every resident in New York City with the lack of maintenance to the system.
What's interesting to me is Con Ed spokespeople say, now, wait a minute. We've got to reel in those pensions. We've got to think about the long run. We don't have money to sustain the pensions and stuff. What do you say? What's really at issue here?
Well,
what's going on?
What is really at issue is they do have a pension fund worth $8 billion. That's with a B. And it is not under any stress. In fact, there will be fewer retirees over time. So when we asked if they had an economic rationale for all these givebacks they're seeking, they said no. They just want to adopt a new business model in America. And we said, well, thank you very much, but, you know, we break our backs to keep the lights on, and we don't think that's a fair return.
John, I see the public pressure has forced them to go back on their reneging on taking away your health care benefits. What do you think is going on with that? And why don't you talk about the additional public pressure that will be placed by your rally?
I'll tell you about the reinstatement of health benefits is that they knew and we knew it was illegal all along. So they were feeling public pressure. But I have to say, with the exception of several members of the city council and a couple of state senators, the silence is deafening from Albany and City Hall. You ought to tell your listeners that the mayor is not responding to their needs, and the people in Albany are not responding for the most part.
What is amazing to me also is you have a CEO that makes $11 million.
Right, but he's also increased his pay 82% in the past 2 years, and at the shareholders meeting in May, he received a package going forward are worth $25 million. And don't forget, he has $18 million in his own cash pension account.
Looking at this obscenity, this incredible disparity between the men and women on the line, the expertise and the danger, of course, of the job itself that they do with such excellence. When you say break the union, what do you mean? How are we to understand this new business model that is so harsh and so one-sided and so obscene in the disparity of payment between what it's willing to give the workers and what the CEOs get?
Look, it's greed, pure and simple. Kevin Burke, the chairman of Con Ed, is a Wall Street darling. They've been paying dividends for 40 years now. It's a buy on all markets, and I think they're shaping up the company to spin it off into a hedge fund. Maybe sell it to something like Bain Capital.
Actually, you're serious, though, aren't you?
I am serious. Yeah. I'm dead serious. They're shaping up their stock prices. They don't want to have any employees any longer. They want contractors. They're bringing in scabs from Alabama, Florida, Virginia, housing them in hotels out by the airport, literally. Dispatching them from parking lots, not Con Ed property. They're trying to break the American dream for middle-class New Yorkers. They put 8,500 New York families back on the taxpayer's back. Kevin Burke is out in his West Hampton house right now. We picketed it out there, and they drew the blinds.
So, John, tell us how we can get involved, how the listeners can get involved.
I think you have to ask your listeners to call the mayor, call the governor, call the councilman. Tell them the lights are going to go out. And until the New York public responds and recognizes the danger that Con Ed has put all New Yorkers in, I don't know what will happen. It's not a labor dispute. We were locked out.
And we have to put our sentiments on the line, supporting their sisters and brothers from Local 1-2 of the Utility workers of America. You know, John, this really is a test case, isn't it?
I think the entire country is watching this. And Kevin Burke and his fellow oligarchs are just counting their money and seeing if they can break the men and women of New York.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.